for this evening, or it's not this evening, it's this morning's talk. It's just when I was having a breakfast at the Venerable Bamar, he asked me what I was going to talk about this morning. And I said, well, I haven't really decided yet. Maybe, I thought of maybe talking about the Four Noble Truths, and then again I remembered that I did promise I'd talk about the Four Stages of Enlightenment. And he commented, yeah, I mean, the Four Stages of Enlightenment are probably more useful. Then the four noble truths are probably more useful. The Four Stages of Enlightenment will probably be more popular because people like to fantasize. It's always good having fantasy. So I decided I'll talk about the Four Stages of Enlightenment today to cheer everyone else up. It's always nice to hear about the good news. So this is a talk on the Four Stages of Enlightenment. But actually, the way the Buddha described me, sometimes called them four stages, sometimes eight, sometimes seven types of people. And all sorts of different ways of looking at this. But in particular, the basic set of the Four Stages of Enlightenment, just in brief, first of all, and then I'll go into detail in a moment, is the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arahat, the fully enlightened being, as the four stages of enlightenment. And each stage represents a deeper and more profound letting go, an abandoning of what the Buddha called fetters, in Pali sang yojana, which are the things which bind one onto this realm of samsara. And as each one of these fetters is abandoned, then one gets, as it were, higher up the rung towards the manhole in the great sky, which takes you out of samsara, if you use the simile of a ladder going upwards. And as such, that the usual way of describing the four stages of enlightenment are in terms of the ten fetters, or the ten sanyojanas. And it's not just an academic description, because it is very informative of what needs to be done, what is abandoned, if one is going to attain to some of these stages, if one is going to get off the wheel of samsara. And it also indicates that the loosening of the bond which ties one to samsara is done gradually. And in that gradual loosening of the bond, there are certain, as it were, knots have to be untied first, and that reveals the knots underneath them, which can be untied second, and so all the final knot is taken off. And so I'll just talk first of all about the fetters, those particular types of attachment which keep one on the wheel of samsara, keep one being reborn, keep one suffering. And the first three fetters, one should know, are in the realm of view, ideas, worldviews, one's understanding of the way the world is, the way oneself is. It's on that particular level. And the particular views, which are the first three fetters, are the... I'm not going to describe them in the usual order. I'm going to change them around a bit. There is the view of which they call Sila Bhatta Paramasa, which is the view that liberation from samsara can be attained just through performing rites, ceremonies, initiations, rituals, by exterior observances. The point being here, the exterior observances. And in other words, by doing either praying or doing some sort of ceremony or heaps of ceremonies, that just by that alone can one cut off attachments and liberate oneself. One should remember that in the time of the Buddha, the dominant religion of the area was Vedic Brahminism, where liberation was assumed to be gained through doing propitiatory sacrifices, by doing ceremonies and whatnot. And the Buddha was saying, well, that's just a completely wrong and erroneous view. That will not take you away from samsara, but bind you to samsara even more. that's Silabhata Paramartha, the view that rites, rituals, ceremonies, observances will lead you out of samsara. The next of these views, which bind one to samsara, is the view of skeptical doubt. And this is a very prominent view in people in the West who will not believe anything. Sometimes they say they won't believe anything unless it's right before their eyes, unless they see it for themselves. But actually, if you test them out and examine them, they won't believe anything unless it fits with what they want to believe, basically. Even if the truth is right before their eyes, still, no, that can't be right, that can't be the way. Which is another type of attachment or to view, a way of protecting one's attachment to one's own well worked out, well thought out, well learnt view of the world. And because of that attachment to one particular view of the world, that's where the skeptical doubt comes from. The inability to really open the mind out and just to see the truth of a view, see whether it's really correct or not. But instead, even before one has even tested it out, skepticism comes in. No, it can't be true. No, I don't think this is right. This cannot be right. Simply because it doesn't fit with the way one wants the world to be, the way one would like the world to be, the way that basically craving would like the world to be. And this is where the skeptical doubt arises, which is the second fetter. So obviously one needs this very open mind to be able to abandon that type of fetter. Instead of going to open skepticism, go to full penetration with the open mind, looking, putting aside all this skeptical idea. Because remember that simile of the biscuit tin which I gave a few days ago? You look at the biscuit tin, what is this? Biscuit tin, biscuit tin. And you have to push aside all your old ideas and views, all your old perceptions, to really have an open mind, to the point where all that you've learned before, all that you've thought before, all your old perceptions of what this is in front of you fall away, so you can see it fresh, see it with an open, new mind, unencumbered by past experiences. And as such, that if I can do that, one will go past this thing we call skeptical doubt. But the heart of these first three fetters, the one which is the main one which is abandoned, and with it go all the other two, is the view of self, the Sakaya Ditti, the view that there is an individual, a being, a person, a me, a self, in here. Whether that's reading the other day that describing this which we know as a human being in terms of five khandhas, it's the Kaya Ditti is the view that somewhere in here there is a self, a me, a mine, a being. And with any of these, whether it's our bodily form, our feeling, our perception, mental formations or consciousness, past, present or future, the Buddha said, far or near, gross or subtle, superior, inferior, any type of consciousness, any type of mental formations, any type of perception, feelings, any type of body, far or near, gross or subtle, superior, inferior, high or low, past, present or future. So to regard any of these as a self, as a me, as belonging to me, or belonging to a self, and this the Buddha said was Sakaya Ditti. It's the view that there is a self somewhere in here. And this was a basic wrong view, the wrong understanding, which kept beings on the wheel of samsara. And this is why that the most important of the Buddha's teachings, the fundamental of the Buddha's teachings, was this illusion of atta, of self. This is the basic meaning of avijja not seeing clearly, not penetrating the Dhamma. So once those three fetters are overcome, once one sees clearly for oneself through penetrating insight, to see that for example, the driver's seat of your bus is completely empty, never was anyone in there, to see that there is no controller inside of you, there is no person being conscious, there's just a process of consciousness, to be able to see that clearly will overcome this view which we call personality view, which is so deeply ingrained in us that it's the biggest of our blind spots. In fact, it's very difficult to even sometimes contemplate that such a blind spot can exist. It seems to be a self-evident fact that I am. And this is why it's such a hard thing to uncover. It needs powerful mind, powerful insight to be able to uncover this truth. When one sees the truth of anatta, sees that particular dhamma, that automatically those three fetters get abandoned. One has seen for oneself with a powerful mind that there was something one assumed to be a self. There was something one assumed to be me. There was an assumption of I, which one had carried around moment by moment, day by day, but goodness knows how long, and one could not see it. Remember that delusion is something that when it's there, you cannot see. Only after it's abandoned, after it's been annihilated, that you can actually see. I was deluded. There was delusion in me. I was looking at life in the wrong way. I was seeing incorrectly. My views were misinformed. And that insight, which is the insight of the stream enterer, is a very powerful insight, because after that one will not look at the world, especially the inner world, in the same way ever again. One will not view it from the point of view of a person doing all of this. And this is the meaning of stream entry. One sees the bus has got no driver in it. Once that attainment is made, the stream enterer, and one experiences that this which we call existence, mental phenomena, reality, is just an empty process, arising and falling, like I was saying the other day, like a string of pearls, but no string passing through it, so there's no essential identity passing through from one moment to the next. When one sees this, it has important consequences over this process itself. To put it bluntly, that once that has been seen, the process goes into its terminal mode. It's terminally ill. It cannot maintain itself for all that much longer. At the very most, it can only keep going for seven more lifetimes. Remember that having seen this particular Dhamma, this particular truth of non-self, never will the idea arise, well, perhaps I can choose to extend this beyond seven lives, or I can choose to make it shorter than seven lives, because you've seen that there's no one there to do the choosing anyway. One sees very clearly that this is a natural process over which there is no person who can exert sort of control, who can make it go fast or make it go slower. You are on the bus, you just have to sit down and wait for it to stop. That's all. So anyone who has at least known that amount of Dhamma, to see the stream entry and to experience the stream entry, knows that the stream enterer, their life left in samsara is very small. The Buddha once gave a simile of the joy, the happiness of a stream enterer. And he said he picked up a piece of dirt on his fingertip and held it up to the monks. And he said, "Monks, which is more, the earth on my fingertip or the dirt in this whole great earth where we live?" And the monks said, it's the usual simile of the Buddha, the monks said, Obviously the Earth in this great globe we call planet Earth is much, much more than the tiny bit of Earth you've got on your fingertip. And the Buddha said, it's the same for a stream enterer. The amount of suffering which they have left, the amount of life which they have left, compared to the amount of suffering they have been through in his many, many journeys through samsara, it's just like the bit on my fingertip compared to the Earth on the whole great planet. They're almost home. Just a tiny bit left. That is like the stream enterer, when one fully sees the truth of anatta. There's nobody in here at all. And that's a hard one to see. That is I often call it the pivot point of the spiritual life of a Buddhist. But once that's been conquered, then everything else just falls into place like a pack of cards. That's the first card which has been pushed over, and then all the other cards, in good time, just fall over. That is the stream enterer. Once one is a stream enterer, some people might ask, why is it if they've overcome delusion, they've seen the truth of non-self, why aren't they fully enlightened already? What is the difference between a fully enlightened being, an arahat, and the stream enterer? If they both have wisdom, they've both seen the Dhamma. And the point is that the stream enterer has seen the Dhamma, as does the arahat. But the arahat has perfected the Dhamma they have seen. Now, the best way of describing this is to use the Buddhist teaching on, I've mentioned this already during this retreat, on the vipalasas, the perversion which occurs on three levels of the mind. The perversion of perception, this is where perception is not true to reality, you add to it something which isn't there. There is the perversion of thought, which is built up of one's perceptions. As we perceive, so like perceptions may be called like the bricks. And as as we perceive, so we build our rooms with these bricks, which are our thoughts, our solid structures. And from our thoughts, we build our views, the houses in which we live, the cities in which we live. Coming from our perceptions, we build up thoughts. Coming from thoughts, we build up our views. And I was pointing out that because of our views, there are our perceptions. If we have very strong views, and our views are usually very strong, whether we admit to it or not, when we have strong views, that it will bend our perceptions accordingly. As I was mentioning, when I was studying science, physics is supposed to be the most logical of doctrines, the logical of sciences. But even so, you can see how biases creep in to even that discipline. One of my favourite stories was of this man called Lord Rayleigh, who was a very, very famous scientist, very famous physicist at the turn of the century. A brilliant man who had made many discoveries. And at this particular time, the turn of the century, he was the president of the Royal Society in London, which was probably the most prestigious society of intellectuals in the world at the time. And at this Royal Society, every now and again, they'd have lectures by prominent people in the field of science. There were demonstrations. And one day, this person came over from the United States to demonstrate this machine which could imitate the human voice. And he turned on this machine, he got it going, and this imitation of the human voice came out, at which point Lord Rayleigh, you know, this English lord, eminent scientist, leader in his field, very famous personage, got up from his seat and started to strangle, choke the person who was operating this machine. Because he was convinced, he'd come from the view that it was impossible, it cannot be done, that anyone can imitate something as God-given as the human voice. And he was convinced that this fellow was nothing more than a ventriloquist who was casting his voice onto this machine, and he took him by the throat to choke him, to prove that this was actually the truth of the matter. He was just ventriloquizing. I don't know if that's the right word, but it sounds good. And anyhow, as soon as he started choking this guy, of course, the machine carried on playing the human voice. It wasn't actually Edison, it was one of his associates demonstrating the phonograph for the first time in England. And it made a fool of this scientist. The reason why he could not accept such a machine could exist was because of his view. These things cannot be done. And that's why he made a fool of himself. It cannot be real, even though it was right before his eyes and ears. And it is a truism, it's one of these sayings, that the eminence of a physicist is measured by the length of time he or she obstructs progress in their field. Because once you're an eminent person, your views are, as it were, dogma. And if anything doesn't fit that view, it is pushed aside. It cannot be true. It cannot be real. Now, I've mentioned this before. If perhaps like a spaceship with aliens from Mars landed in the garden outside, a real dinky-dyed UFO, and they came in here with all their antennas and their tentacles and stuff, would you believe that they came from Mars? If they came in here and say, I'm from Mars, take me to your leader. You'd probably just burst out laughing. You wouldn't believe them at all, would you? Because our view is so strong, that cannot be true. That there are people in outer space, at least Mars, and they say such stupid things. It cannot be true. And because you think it cannot be true, you will not perceive it to be that way. View is actually very, very strong, the way it bends our perceptions of the world. Well, it bends our perceptions of our mind. And this is what I'm talking about by the vipalasas, the way that view bends perception, that perception bends thought, and the way that thought bends view again. We've got this vicious cycle, which is very hard to break. It's only through abandoning five hindrances, through having a very powerful mind, we can cut that habitual self-conditioning cycle of views giving rise to perceptions, giving rise to thoughts, giving rise to views, all justifying one another, like three psychopaths saying how good they each are. Now, the first part of that cycle which is broken is view. Despite what one perceives, despite what one thinks, despite what one viewed in the past. Hang on. One is actually seeing. These are actually Martians. Wow. What a surprise. One sees. Actually, there is no self in here. Wow. What a surprise. I never expected this. Insight will always be what you don't expect. Insight will not confirm your old perceptions, thoughts and views, but will challenge them to the very core. Insight will change you. That's why true insight is very frightening. It makes you feel very insecure when you realize how much you have to give up. I'm not talking about giving a donation to a monastery. I'm talking about donating something which is so close to you, so personal, your own views. Sometimes that people are afraid if, like, monks can read minds, because it's so close to you, isn't it? It's even worse than, like, getting you undressed and seeing your body. This is seeing inside of your own mind. That's really private stuff. The more private and personal it is, the harder it is to give up. So this is the attainment of stream entry, which will shock, shatter, turn you, as it were, completely around. And it's not something which can be thought out. There's no way you can think yourself into giving up these things, because thinking just preserves old views. The only way you can do this is with this insight which sees clearly into the depths of yourself through the power of samadhi. Samadhi is the proximate cause for the arising of insight. Because of samadhi, the Buddha said, you can see things as they truly are, not without samadhi. Which is why in Buddhism we spend so much time meditating and building up the power of samadhi. Now, to go back to my question of why is the arahat different than the stream enterer, the stream enterer has purified view. No longer, ever again, can they view there to be a self, a me, a mine in here at all. However, it takes a time for that view, that purified view, to filter through and, as it were, recondition the functions of perception and the functions of thought. Much of the perception and thought will still be conditioned by the old ways of thinking, the old ways of viewing, rather. And it is why that once a person has seen the truth, there's actually a training to be done. A training to start perceiving according to that view, to start thinking according to that view, to start perceiving and thinking in terms of not me, not mine, not a self. That is why the training, as it were, truly starts for the stream enterer. Once a person is a stream enterer, once they've got the view right, they're also called in Pali by the Buddha, Seka, one in learning, one in training. They got their L plates. Once they've got their L plates, it's only a matter of time before they get their full license. Now what one does after one has purified one's view, then one has to purify one's perception and thoughts. In particular, the perception that something is beautiful, permanent, a source of happiness, in my control, mine. And the thoughts which come from that. The thoughts which come from that perception, oh, this is wonderful, this is beautiful, this is attractive, this is a source of happiness, this is worthwhile. The thoughts which come from that are called craving, desire and aversion. Desire and aversion manifest as the thoughts in your mind. To want, to acquire, to possess and to protect, to keep. This is called craving. That craving to possess, to seek for pleasure, works on two levels. The pleasures of the body and the pleasures of the mind. And you should know by now that the pleasures of the mind are far superior than the pleasures of the body, the pleasures of the world. That's why the pleasures of the mind are the hardest to give up. As one is giving up the perceptions and the thoughts in the mind based on craving, one will give up the perceptions and thoughts of craving based on the external world, first of all. The perceptions and thoughts of happiness and pleasure are concerned with the five senses, with sensuality, sexuality, food, physical comfort, pleasure and pain in the body, that world. Only because of the view of non-self can such an abandoning be done. If one still thinks of the body as something to do with me, mine, if one still hasn't seen the truth of non-self, you will not be able to give up such attachments. Pleasure will still call you. And still, like the fish taking the worm, will also take the hook as well. Sensual pleasures will just still be alluring. One will not be able to abandon them because a self, an idea of a self, will always want to control. We'll always want to amass, we'll look for security, we'll look for pleasure. This is a function of a self. Once it's a self, there has to be things which a self owns, has to be things which it does. If you think that the body and this world outside have something to do with you, then you'll be concerned to make this body and the world outside pleasurable. And you'll struggle to avoid the pain in a frantic, desperate way. This is called like the craving for sensory pleasures, and the ill will born of the frustration of that craving. In terms of the 10 fetters, you will read that this is the 4th and 5th fetter. Kama raga, the raga, the lust, the attachment, the craving towards this external world, the body and the world of possessions outside. And vyapada, the ill will, which is intimately connected with this. You know, you can't give up anger without giving up lust. You can't give up lust without giving up anger. The two go together. Whenever sensory desire is not fulfilled or frustrated, so often people blame somebody else. It's his fault, or it's the traffic light's fault, because I'm not getting to the concert in time. It's always that ill will which is based on the frustration of sensory comfort, sensory pleasure, sensory desire. So that's why these two are a pair. They're given up together. Once they are given up, then that is called the anagami, the non-returner. Because the anagami, the non-returner, has given up the seeking for satisfaction and delight in the realm of the five senses, realizing that realm is not his or hers, regarding it in, as that simile I gave the other day, as the sticks and the leaves in the jeta grove, regarding it as just a house which one is renting, realizing one would have to give it up eventually, one is not really the owner. Only then can one have this equanimity towards the body and the world. Only then can the craving be abandoned, when you realize it's not your, you don't own this thing. Only when the leaves and the twigs outside are considered to be not your problem, nothing to do with you, will you take away your craving for their maintenance and well-being. This is the anagami, the non-returner. Because the craving to this world of forms, of body, of grass and sand and ocean and all these other things which people delight in this world, because that craving has been completely cut off, there's nothing to bring them back to this realm. When they die, they go to a realm made of mind called the Sudhavasa, the pure abodes. The attachment that the anagamis have, that which stops them fully entering cessation, is the happiness of the mind. Basically, the jhana states. The 6th and 7th fetters are called rupa raga and arupa raga. They correspond precisely to the craving for the rupa jhanas, the 4 jhanas which I explained the other day, and the craving for the 4 arupa jhanas. Because this is where this is where the anagami finds fun and enjoyment and pleasure. The non-returner who has access to those states and knows those states very well will never look to the world for pleasure and happiness, but will always look towards his higher happiness. This actually is the attachments which come from gaining jhanas. Sometimes the people do say that you should be careful of jhanas, you'll get attached to them. You know, it's true in a sense, but it's the attachment of the anagami, of the non-returner. That's not a bad attachment to keep if you're going to keep some attachments. You're just that far from enlightenment. So that's why that I remember talking with one of the great monks in Thailand about this, and he laughed when I told him that some people say that you shouldn't do jhanas because you get attached to them. He thought that was very amusing. And he said, look, he said, tell them that the attachments to jhanas, they're the easy ones to get rid of. It's the other attachments are the ones you should be worried about. the other attachments to the world, they're the really difficult ones to get rid of, and they're the main problems. The attachments to jhana are just tiny little things, and if you actually keep them, the very worst you can do is to become an anagami, a non-returner, which again is not really that bad. If you're a non-returner, you know what happens to you? You go into this world of bliss for, oh, I don't know how many eons, in the realm of like a few thousand eons, you know, just enjoying the bliss of jhanas for eon after eon after eon, really blissed out, and so eventually finally you get tired of that and then you just go into nibbana. It's not a bad way of going out of the samsara. Just blissing out for 1,000 or 2,000 or 64,000 eons, and at the end of it there's no return to the lower realms, then you just peter out, disappear. No illness or sickness in those realms. No arguments. No mosquitoes in the Sudawasa. So the attachments to jhanas, even though they're attachments, so, the Buddha was here, he probably ticked me off by saying all attachments should be got rid of. And don't encourage anyone to have any attachments. But attachments have to be given up in order. I often like the simile of going up a ladder. You're going up a ladder, you have to actually grasp and attach to the rung above you. That's the one you should attach to, so you can pull yourself up. And you have to let go, not of the rung above you, but the rung below you. Let go of the lower things, first of all, as you attach to the higher things. And you pull yourself up until soon that where you actually hung onto and grasped onto with your hand to pull yourself up, now you're standing on. And your arm is reaching up to an even higher rung. That's the time to let go of that rung, because you're now standing on it. You're now just about to go past it. So attachments have to be given up in order. And don't be afraid of grasping onto things like these beautiful mind states, or grasping onto things like virtue. You pull yourself up by grasping onto virtue. And then when you want to grasp onto something higher like samadhi, then grasp onto that and don't worry about your virtue for a while. Actually, the virtue will happen automatically, naturally. You don't have to like grasp it. And this is the way you pull yourself up the ladder. So the anagami is still stuck in the bliss of the mind. It's also got the other three fetters, the last three fetters, the 8th, 9th and 10th, is mana, udicca and avijja. The mana is just the thought, sometimes perception, which is still that this is me doing this, which is another manifestation of the delusion, still manifesting, not in views, but in perceptions and thoughts. And the udicca being the restlessness. Still there's not that perfect stability of mind of the arahat. Those are the last three fetters of the 10 fetters. But the major fetters for the anagami is the attachment to jhana blisses, aruparaga. Once the anagami sees even those are impermanent, they arrive and pass away, even those are not a manifestation of the self, even those, actually he's already seen that one, is actually seeing that they're impermanent and seeing that there's something beyond those states, there's a cessation. That even the blisses of jhana are suffering in a very refined form. And when the anagami sees that, then you can let go of that final attachment, the attachment to mind. Before, he'd given up the attachment to body, basically, and the world outside. Now the anagami gives up the attachment to mind. And with no attachment left at all, not attached to consciousness, the conscious experience, to feeling, the perceptions, the thoughts, having completely, as it were, relinquished them, then there is nothing which will make the arahats get reborn. They're just passing time according to karma, making the best use of that time by helping and serving, teaching, being compassionate to others. This is the arahat. But when the time that the body has to die, then with it, as it were, dies the mind. Not something being annihilated, but as I mentioned the other day, just one switch going on, then going off, and no more switches being put on again. The whole process has ended. And that's the arahat. As such, there's some things which the stream enterer can't do, there's things which the anagami can't do, there's things which the arahat can't do. And such things like the stream enterer, having seen non-self, also sees the Four Noble Truths, sees it as an impersonal process, sees the essence of suffering, dukkha, that dukkha is with all sensory experience. Once you realize that this sensory experience has nothing to do with you, it's not yours, you don't have to protect it, you can actually be quite critical to it. Now that which we think is really ours, which we possess, we don't like to have it criticized. Now if it's my body, you know, we like to think our body is good, it's beautiful. If someone comes along and says, you've got a really stinking body, you're really sort of a stupid person, then because it's us, we just do not like that criticism, especially that negative criticism. If we think that there's something inside of us which is ours, we will never allow that ultimate criticism that this is dukkha. This is unpleasant, this is unsatisfactory, this is unhappiness, this is pain. Because it's just too personal to us. We think we spent so much time developing our personality, our views, our experiences. When someone comes along and says, this is dukkha, what do you mean? This is not suffering, this is beautiful, this is lovely. It's only by attaining to that understanding of non-self that one can even contemplate that all this can be dukkha, that sensory experience can be suffering, that the mind can be suffering, even in its most exalted states, that the body is just a mass of dukkha. If you think the body is mine, there's no way you can accept that. The view will not allow the perception of thought to arise. And that's actually where the argument comes from, the resistance. It all comes down to the fact that we guard an area of purity or apparent purity, which we like to call ourselves, because that's our blind spot. So when a person becomes a stream enterer, they also see dukkha. Those three characteristics are just one and the same facet of the same experience. What is anicca, impermanent, is dukkha. What is dukkha is non-self. What is non-self is impermanent. What is impermanent is non-self. What is non-self is dukkha. What is dukkha is impermanent. Three aspects of the same experience. We've got that sensory experience. Can't you see that that's impermanent, rises and passes away? Even for that reason, that's why it's dukkha. Even the sensory experience of an arahat is sight consciousness, mind consciousness, sound consciousness, that arises and passes away. That's why it's dukkha. So once a person sees this, then they see what the Buddha was talking about and point to dukkha. Non-self, impermanence. Actually, you see it. So you see all of these three truths in the realm of view. Later on, you can perfect it. So every perception, every thought, you see as non-self, dukkha, impermanent. That's all you see. Another sense perception, impermanent, rising, passing away. Just dukkha, just non-self. Which is why that arahat bhikkhuni Wajira, when she was questioned by Mara, said, who is this saying these things? He said, there's no one here, non-self. Dukkha arising, dukkha passing away. That's dukkha and impermanence. Said with the greatest eloquence, worthy of a person who's truly fathomed the Dhamma. So that's the arahat. At the stream entering, one sees all of those anicca, dukkha, anatta at the same time. One sees the Four Noble Truths. One sees how all this started. and one sees how it will end, automatically you cannot stop it. An empty process. The attainments of these things, they happen in certain stages. In Pali, sometimes they're called Magga and Pala, the path and the fruit. Some of you may have come across this. And again, there's much discussion amongst the monks with the Abhidharma description and the description in the suttas. And experience, as usual, agrees with what's in the suttas, what the Buddha said, rather than the commentators which came afterwards. And because in the Abhidharma, they actually say that the entry, for example, stream entry, occurs just a few milliseconds before you gain the fruit of stream entry. But Magga is almost like a flash before you get the fruit. However, in the suttas, actually they give two types of person who's on the path to stream entry. And this is already like, he's supposed to be like a noble one at this time. One of the Aryas. A person is on the path to stream entry. There's two types. There's the Dhammanusari and the Sadhanusari. The one who is like the faith follower, and the one who is the wisdom follower. Follows because of Dhamma. And what this is, what these two mean, and it's interesting because you understand what a stream enterer on the path to stream entry is the Sadhanusari has got so much, they've got an amount of wisdom, but they've got so much confidence and faith in the teachings of the Buddha, and the correct teachings of the Buddha, not any old teachings of the Buddha, not teachings of what they think are the Buddha's teachings, but what actually are the Buddha's teachings. They've got so much faith in those teachings, they've already committed themselves to follow them, and it's only a matter of time until they fully penetrate those teachings with wisdom. Again, sometimes the power of faith can be problematical. It can lead in all sorts of directions. But at least everyone should know it's a great power and strength. And if that power of faith is, as it were, guided by wisdom, by rational thought, by investigation, by being honest to experience, then if that faith is rooted in the Buddha's Dhamma, then it has to mature in seeing that Dhamma. In particular, one may reject instinctively the gut feeling, the idea of non-self. It cannot be true. It doesn't feel right. But then you have faith that, well, everything else the Buddha teaches seems to be so powerful and so good. And I do meditation, I get some results. A sense of faith comes up that this thing which I find hard to swallow, everything else seems so good that one has the faith to investigate. One does not reject it out of hand. One has the faith, the confidence to say, well, it might be right. Actually, it probably is right, even though I can't understand it. The faith in what the Buddha teaches is greater than the faith in one's gut feelings. So one investigates. And as such, that one is on the path to stream entry. The other person on the path to stream entry is a Dhammanusari, the person who has got enough strength of wisdom that they can appreciate on a reflective level the truth of non-self. It fits, it sounds right, it agrees with their gut feelings, because their guts have been cleaned out by doing a lot of meditation and a lot of insight practice. And such a person is a Dhammanusari. They've got enough reflective experience, understanding of such things as non-self, that all things are non-self, that all things are suffering. But again, that the obstacle of skeptical doubt, as it were, has been weakened so much. But again, it's only a matter of time. It's difficult to actually say who's the Dhammanusari and who's the Sadhanusari. Like, who's predominantly guided by the reflective wisdom, even though it's not the full wisdom of an attainment of stream entry. And who is the the sadhanusari, the one who's predominantly working through faith. Their wisdom isn't as strong yet, but they've just got such confidence that the Buddha has obviously got something really important. But either of them is called a stream. One is on the path of stream entry. It's the first of the noble ones. They say actually that anyone who's on the path of stream entry, they have to achieve the result of stream entry in that very life. If not beforehand, at the time of death. And it's a very important point, this, and it's a very interesting point as well, that because at the time of death, you're having to let go of your body, you're having to abandon something. But a person who is on the path to stream entry, they've got either reflective understanding of the Dhamma, or they've got great faith in the Buddha, in his teachings. Cannot happen otherwise. That they see the Dhamma at that point. They see non-self as their body is completely out of their control, as their mind also is showing its natural, no-controller type mind. The experience of death is a very powerful time. If you have the strength, the insight, and the wisdom to not be too concerned with pain and the physical discomfort of body, please try and refuse those drugs which make you die in a state which the doctors and your family find peaceful. As for you, you don't die peacefully, you die in a cloud. Many of those palliatives which people give at the time of death are actually for the doctor and the relations, so they don't suffer so much seeing you in pain. So be careful there, especially if you've got some understanding of the Dhamma. See if you can die, spend your last few moments with full mindfulness, completely aware. You know, what I've been told, what I've read, is that for all people, whether they're giving morphine or not, no matter how, so actually if they're not given morphine, if they're not giving any painkillers, even if they're in very great pain in the last moments, there does come a time just before they die where the pain disappears and they've got clear mindfulness. There is apparently, some people might know this better than I do, there's apparently some chemicals which are naturally secreted from the body just before death which gets rid of pain, and a person actually dies usually with this last few moments of space of being free from pain, at peace with their body. And this is, I remember reading a Tolstoy story about this, one of his works, where a person in great pain dying in the days when they didn't have such palliatives, and screaming his head off day and night and sending the household crazy. But then just before he died, his screaming stopped. He became peaceful and reflective, only for a few minutes, and then he completely passed away. And it was a story which is actually quite common in experience. The greatest palliative is secreted by your own body just before the end. If you can just last to that point, then you can get that mindfulness to really contemplate what's going on. And that's a very common time when people can at least gain this full stream entry and see the truth of our body and mind, see the truth of this life. Now, we all say all of our possessions, we never take them with us, but we sure try hard in our life. But at the very end, that truth is just, you can't sort of push it aside anymore. You have to face up to it. And that's why it's a very important moment. So if you're on the path of stream entry, then the time of death becomes, if not beforehand, becomes a really powerful time when the full stream entry, becoming a stream enterer, seeing the Dhamma, can actually happen. It's as if you've got nothing to lose at that time. Therefore, you've got nothing to protect. And you can go deeper than the battlements of your ego. It's like the ego lives in a castle inside, and it will not let you in the door. And it will protect its boundaries so mindfulness can't even get close. When the time of death, all the doors of the castle are open. And if you've got mindfulness, you can go right inside and see again like it's just an empty castle, an illusion. That's the attainment of stream entry. However, if you've already got stream entry, then your task is to develop that wisdom, that insight, that pure view with mindfulness in every moment. You know what mindfulness is? It's not just being completely aware, but remembering what you should be doing. Just like in meditation, you are mindful of the content of your consciousness, but if you're a skillful meditator, you're always remembering what the steps are, where you are, what you have to be doing. Whether it's watching the first stage, or letting go of the samadhi nimitta, relaxing, or whatever. The mindfulness is also that which keeps informing you of the Dhamma. The stream enterer has to perfect that degree of mindfulness that in every moment of perception and thought, the mindfulness keeps coming back. Impermanent, dukkha, non-self. So the last of the cravings are abandoned through that full awareness in every moment of impermanence, unsatisfactory, non-self. The view is informing every perception, every thought. And there will come a time when the practitioner will realize that they have finally abandoned once and for all their attachment to the world of the five senses. Their attachment, they've fully abandoned all sensuality, sexuality, concern for the physical world. And they know that because, like, pain is just seen as pain and will not have the same effect on them ever again. Physical pleasure is just physical pleasure. It is something which arises and passes away. Pleasure just the gap between two painful experiences. Pain just the gap between two pleasurable experiences. That's all. You know that pleasure is going to go in a moment. Pain is going to go in a moment. It's going to ebb and flow like the tides of the ocean. That's all there is to it. How on earth can you bother to be concerned about something which you cannot control, like good old King Canute trying to force the tides to go in or to go out? He realizes it cannot be done. Dispassion, equanimity, letting go, giving up. This world of the five senses. Instead of trying to shout at the tides, come in, go out, you just sit there, peaceful. You've got no more business to do with that world. That's why you're equanimous. There comes a time when one realizes that the fruit of non-return has happened. The path of developing that non-return is very much for the stream enterer of developing the jhanas, which makes the mind to look for its happiness not in that world out there, but in the world inside. That's why, actually, that I've already mentioned the faith follower and the wisdom follower, the Dhammanusari. The Dhammanusari, the one who has the reflective acceptance of the Dhamma, when they attain the fruit of stream entry, they're called the Dittipata, the one attained to view. It's sometimes that people say, well, the idea of Buddhism is to give up all views. And there was a person who came up to the Buddha and said, I've got no views. And of course, you know what the Buddha said? That's a view. And he said, oh, okay, well, let that one be. Because you can't get out of it, can you? Even if you say, I have no views, then that becomes your view. And to exist on this world, just as much that to exist you have to have perception. You have to have thinking. Sometimes you can escape thinking by going into, say, a jhana. But, I mean, thinking is part of having a mind in its natural state. In the same way that view is part of having a mind. The point of view is not to abandon views, but to keep them in perspective, what they are. The Dittipato, being one who attains the view, seeing the Dhamma, understands that particular view which leads out of enlightenment, which leads out to enlightenment, which leads out of samsara. You've understood the way out. You found the tunnel out of your prison cell. And it's a tunnel which was built by the Buddha, and many people have escaped over the centuries. And this is, you've attained to view. The other one who is faith is the one who is like Sadawimuta, is liberated by faith. Again, still the stream enterer. But the person who has gained the stream entry mostly through the power of faith. Again, they've both seen the Dhamma. They've seen exactly the same thing. They've seen Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, the very heart, fully. There's no part of the mental, physical person which hasn't been seen as Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta. And the other person who's on the path being enlightened is called the Kaya-sakin. They call it the body witness. The person who's witnessed these things for themselves. And this is the person who, as a stream enterer, is developing this full mindfulness which can abandon, and by such doing gains not just the four rupa jhanas, but the arupa jhanas as well, who takes giving up, letting go to such a point that they can develop such things as full cessation of not just of body, but of feeling and perception as well. They've experienced, they've witnessed, rather, the mind ceasing. And as such, the person who can witness the mind ceasing is called like the Kaya-sakhi. They've known through their own experience that all of this ends, and the ending is the highest happiness. As such, as I mentioned the other day, the person who can achieve cessation, when they actually touch cessation, is the word, the same way a person that touches the servant's flask here, when you touch cessation, you touch the door, and then there's no more consciousness, there's no more feeling or perception. And when you emerge from that state, you touch, as it were, you see the door, and you come out again. That's how you can witness that such a thing has happened. And knowing that much, you have to emerge either as a non-returner or a full arahat. There are only two possibilities. If you're a non-returner, you're like a Kaya-sakin. You've witnessed it yourself. Cessation. If you are become the full arahat, you fully let go of even that pleasure, that dhamma, then you are, they say, liberated in both ways. Liberated through wisdom. So almost like the inferential knowledge, you've seen so much cease, you can infer, you can understand what it's like for everything to cease. You know cessation not through direct experience, but through experiencing so much of it, you can work out the rest for yourself, as it were. The one who can experience it all is called the one liberated both ways. Liberated by mind, liberated through wisdom. The one who hasn't achieved those four arupa jhanas, the immaterial absorptions, who hasn't tasted cessation for themselves, is called the one liberated through wisdom. But even the one liberated through wisdom still has to be the one who's experienced the four jhanas. You cannot be an arahat without those four jhanas. You have to perfect the Eightfold Path, the last of which is Sammasamadhi. Of all of those attainments, the two which will always stand out for the practitioner is the first and the last. The attainment of stream entry, because that's such an important turning point in one's spiritual career, where from that time on you know that the end is unavoidable. You can actually see this process for the five khandhas. There's no way it can keep on going for too much longer. And also the point of arahat, where you see the last of the craving fully overcome. That's why actually in one of the most beautiful teachings of the Buddha. He said a monk should venerate three places in his life. Should venerate the place where he first went forth, like as a novice, when he first took the brown robe. That's the first place you should always remember and venerate. The second place which you should venerate is the place where you gained stream entry, where you first saw the Dhamma, saw what the Buddha saw. And the third place you should venerate would be the place where you completely destroyed all craving, all intoxicants, the asavas, where you became arahat. Those are the three places that you should revere in the world. These attainments happen at a particular place, at a particular time in your so-called spiritual career. It's not as if that one day you wake up and think, well, I suppose I must be a stream enterer because of this or that. It happens as an event in your life. As does things like arahat. The only way you can know where you are is to know the status. Always be very honest to yourself. Never go around telling anyone else. As I mentioned the other day, that nun in Korea, was it Taiwan? I forget now. One of those places anyway. Was saying that never ever, if you ever get any of these status, never ever go around telling your friends. Maybe you can just go and tell your teacher and no one else. If you go around telling anyone else, you spend the rest of your life, not just signing autographs, but the rest of your life having to prove it. The people go looking for you, like they did with the Buddha. Now he says he's an arahat. He thinks he's an arahat. I'm going to look at him. Look at him, sort of, he's reading the newspaper. Arahats don't read newspapers, or do they read newspapers? Look at him, that sort of, you know, he's smiling. Look at her, you know, she's putting jam on her bread in a toast in the morning. That shows desire, doesn't it? And you go into all this sort of stupid stuff, and people actually do this. When they hear that someone is an arahat, or that someone is a stream enterer, or someone has got jhana, a lot of people spend their time saying, because they get so threatened, why him, why her, why not me? They can't be. Him? Nah, come on, they can't be a stream enterer. And it's actually, instead of developing the Buddhist quality of mudita, which is like the joy at another person's success, most people develop jealousy. Not most people, but some people. And they're the ones that are going to cause you trouble. So, if any of these things ever happen to you, be quiet. Otherwise you get into big trouble. And actually, if a person who goes around bragging anyway, that I'm enlightened, I mean, that's one of the surest signs that anyone with such a big ego cannot be enlightened. So anyway, those are the stages of enlightenment. And again, there's nothing higher than an arahat, than a fully enlightened being. Once you've eradicated all craving, all greed, hatred and delusion, there's nothing more you can do. The Buddha mentioned that several times. The person who's an arahat, there's nothing more to be done. They've reached the summit, they're at the end. And he said, their attainment is no different than mine, the Buddha said. Just as I've overcome craving, just as I've ended samsara, there's no more birth for me. Just for the arahat, it's the same. No more birth. It's really ended. So you've seen the problem. The problem's been solved. And then just live quietly in the world. So, let's see. Talk about the four stages of enlightenment. As I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, that sometimes people like to fantasize. But don't think this is just your fantasy. These things can be achieved. They should be achieved. Why not? If you've seen enough of the Dhamma so far, why not take it to its culmination? The alternative is just more and more this birth than this life than this death. Buddha said that you've been filling the graveyards of the world. Many of those bones which the archaeological people excavate are yours, in your previous lives. So when will you have enough of this? So anyway, has anyone got any questions about this morning's talk? Oh, got a few, okay. Yes, Mike.
Said in this talk tonight, I think this morning, that sort of insight comes from concentration, mm-hmm. So, in other words, this insight is liberating insight, and it depends upon getting the thought. And it goes with something which we can't just let the switch on, but I'm going to get the thought. Then the attachment, a lot of attachment can build up to sort of torture and wanting to become absorbed. And I found that desire to become absorbed comes through the construction to actually get absorbed. And so people say, oh, don't bother trying. Don't, there's some attachment to these, if you really attach to these absorptions. And then this is an excuse for fear. Oh, it's too hard. So I think we're going to have to be trying to
get it. Yeah, exactly what happens. That it's sometimes it's because the teachers can't do the absorptions themselves. So they go and tell others, well, they're not necessary. Or to even stop them trying, if they don't do these things, you'll get attached to them. But if you read the Buddha's teaching, read the suttas, you'll find the Buddha never said that. He never said, don't do these. He said, don't be afraid of them. Don't be afraid of that pleasure. Don't be afraid of that attachment, which will come naturally from these things. And it's good to desire absorptions, to aim for them. However, desire can be an obstacle, but it does not have to be an obstacle. In fact, not desiring or aiming for those absorptions is an even greater obstacle. If you don't aim for them, you'll never get there at all. If you aim for them, if you desire them, you aspire towards them, you've got a chance of getting there, as long as you have the wisdom to know how to work with such desires and aspirations. It's like the simile of shooting an arrow. You aim the arrow, but once it's left the bow, you've got to let it go in its natural course. You can't go aiming and desiring once the bow has left the arrow. You're just wasting your time and messing things up. In the meditation, if you're going to aim for the jhanas, point your mind in that direction. Set up the courses. Shoot the arrow. That's when you let go. If you're always aiming, then you're not shooting. So it's good to aim, but know how to use that desire, that aiming, that aspiration, desire for the jhanas, and when actually to let go of that thing. And then you actually attain these things. I'm sure that because of the bliss of these states, it's quite common that one would get attached to them. However, because these jhana states, they do abandon hindrances, they make the mind very powerful and clear afterwards, that is very easy, having attained those states, to look back upon them. Remember the Buddha's teachings. And as you look back upon them, recalling the Buddha's teachings, even though they're blissful and the most delightful thing one has ever experienced, and they appear to be the most permanent things one has ever experienced, the most selfless things one has ever experienced. One looks back upon those things and remembers that this too is suffering, the Buddha said. The arahats, the great ones, have been here before. And with that, and this is actually straight from the suttas, seeing the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, the non-selfness of even these refined states, standing on that experience, the meditator turns away to the deathless, to the stilling, the abandoning of all sankharas, even those ones. He turns to the deathless, to nibbana, and there gives up the attachment to those beautiful states. Once and for all, becomes an enlightened being. That's how it works. You have to, this is a very high rung on the ladder. Reach up and grab it if you can. If you can get hold of it and get a firm grip on these jhanas, they'll pull you up a long way. And when your feet are standing on those jhanas, as it were, then just reach up to the last rung, to the arahat, and then you can lift your feet off very easily off the jhana. So, you had a question?
Yes. Can you explain what level of absorption would be required to make the mind powerful enough to gain insight and meditation?
Say, what level of samadhi is necessary to gain, like, some of the great insights? And again, this is a fascinating topic of discussion amongst the monks. Certainly there's no doubt that you have to have the jhanas to gain the insights of to be an anagami or to be an arahat. There's no way out of that one. Before you can perfect wisdom, have it fully there all the time, you have to have perfected samadhi, which is defined as perfecting the four jhanas. However, the fascinating one is like stream entry. Do you need jhana to be a stream enterer? Or can you do it without jhana? And monks, we talk a lot about this in the monastery, and write letters to one another, and you've got all these various views about whether it's possible or not. And as I would explain it to you, that it is possible to gain the attainment of stream entry without a jhana. Just on the upachara samadhi, the neighborhood concentration, just before that type of samadhi, where the hindrances are fully overcome. However, having said that, it's possible. I always add a simile. It's also possible to walk from here to Sydney. However, if I was going to Sydney, I would try and get an airline ticket, or at least a train or a bus ticket, or at least try and get a lift in somebody's car to get a decent vehicle. And the airline ticket is like fourth jhana. That's the most comfortable way and the fastest way to get to these things. However, at least if you've got some sort of vehicle, even like the first jhana, even if it's a Capsar old VW car or something, still that you can get to Sydney in with not too much trouble. If it's like a first jhana, you can gain stream entry. Obviously, the deeper the samadhi, the more powerful the mind, the more likely it is to see these deep truths. Some years ago I gave a simile. It's like the truths, the Dhamma, is like a buried treasure, buried deep in your heart. But in this simile, it's like buried in the forest. The teachings of the Buddha are like a map, a treasure map. X marks the spot. And to get into the forest, which is very dark, you need a flashlight. And the flashlight is the level of samadhi which you've got. And the insight is like following the instructions and looking there, seeing where the treasure actually is. But without the strong flashlight, you may have all the instructions, the best instructions in the world. Without the flashlight, you just can't find out where you are. And also, you cannot sort of gain that sort of clarity of mind to really see this very treasure. You might walk right over it and not notice it. So samadhi is like having a strong flashlight. And that's actually how it feels. the more depth of samadhi you've got, the more bright the mind is, the more penetrating it is. It is like shining a flashlight on something. You just see more of what you're looking at. And at least have a one battery flashlight, the first jhana, but a four battery flashlight is so strong that if you're going through there, you've got the instructions, the treasure map, and you go looking in there with such a strong mind, it's very difficult to miss. So that's the point, the purpose of the jhanas with these attainments. Stream entry, though, can be done without it. However, the more jhanas you do, you're really increasing your chances enormously. That's why there's another monk I respect very greatly in Sri Lanka, Venunyana Wimala. He's one of my heroes. And if ever you see his life story, it's just, he's such a strong monk. I think about, was it 30 years or something? He just never spent the rain's retreat in two consecutive places, just walked around the island of Sri Lanka. Just no one knew where he was. And just a few possessions carrying what he could with him. He was one of the most frugal, ascetic monks you can imagine, but because he had incredible samadhi. And he was saying, that for all practical purposes, you need at least first jhana to get stream entry. Yeah. He's asking about rites and rituals and the attachment to rites and rituals. Actually, it's not the attachment to rites and rituals, but the attachment to the idea that rites and rituals are really going to serve a great purpose in the spiritual path.